Okay, for those of you that may not have been with us in past years, we're going to be covering some material, and I will welcome your comments and questions, particularly your comments, but Lowell will have a mic. I don't know if you'll have quite as many comments and questions tonight as you might in subsequent nights, but I've been asked, or I've been allowed, maybe that's the right way to say it, to discuss worship with you this week. And I'm going to be dealing not... I will deal some with what is worship, but we'll be looking at public worship probably more than private worship. And to give you a little roadmap, and I'll try to stick to this, I want us particularly in subsequent nights, like tomorrow night, I want to deal with the Lord's Supper and talk about various foundational issues, but why do we do it every Sunday? Is it appropriate to do it outside of the assembly, i.e. nursing homes, i.e. On vacation? What about the concept of doing it multiple times on the Lord's Day? And if you have particular issues on that you would like for us to consider, let me know. Probably Wednesday night, if it goes as planned, we'll deal with the mutual edification concept, of which differentiates us from many other churches. Are we giving our best to the Lord when we go mutual ministry? Should everybody be used? Or should just those that are maybe a little more polished be used? I want to deal with some practical aspects of it. Thursday, probably, unless we get ahead of ourselves, we'll be talking about instrumental music and singing. And I want to spend some time, and I'm not sure if this will be Friday, I may intersperse this, on how we should conduct ourselves during the worship service. I've been asked specifically by several of you for us to consider that. But tonight, and we may get into some of those, so I wanted to let you know so that if you have specific questions or things about the worship service that you would like for us to discuss, feel free to let me know, and as best we can, we'll introduce them as they are edifying. But what I find often happens with myself, and maybe you find it with yourself, is there's an anxiousness to jump into those practical questions, and if we lay a little bit of foundation about what worship is all about, a lot of those practical questions, at least for me, just naturally get answered by the outflow of it. For instance, when we understand really, at least I think, when we understand what the communion is all about, then questions about whether we should take it outside of the assembly or not almost become self-answering. Now, that they may not seem that way to you, but they do seem that way to me. And if we just jump into this without some biblical foundation, what we often end up with is something we all enjoy, but I don't know how edifying it is. We end up with 45 minutes of I think, or it seems to me. Well, it's important what you think, and it's important what I think, but the gospel according to me or the gospel according to you is totally irrelevant. The only one that's relevant is the gospel according to the Lord. We need some biblical foundation for that. Sometimes we talk about relevancy of worship. There are people that really don't believe that worship is essential. A deist, for instance, of which most of our founding fathers were, would not consider worship to be that important, because the deist believes that God created the earth, but from that point on, he's relatively uninvolved. So you give honor to God for creation, but you're not then saddled, if that's the word, with a day-to-day implication of the Lord. So we'll be dealing with some of those things. I just wanted to give you a little bit of a roadmap. I definitely am going to deal with all of those subjects, but there will be more that will come up, and feel free to request specific things, and if it looks like it's something of interest to the whole group, we'll discuss it. If not, I'll be happy to discuss it with you one-on-one. But when God commanded man to worship, he was merely asking us to do what is our natural inclination. Now, it's not necessarily our natural inclination to worship God, but it is our natural inclination to worship. I don't think there's ever been a society or ever been a civilization that didn't worship. I don't personally think there's ever been a person that didn't worship. Now, sometimes the things we worship aren't righteous. They may be money, they may be jobs, they may be education, but we have a tendency to worship. But I think most people, as the Bible says, God has set eternity in our hearts. And even the most callous would have to admit or come to a conclusion that there is some higher being. Now, it's not politically correct to call that higher being God in our society, but whatever they call it, they get to some point of it being a higher being. It is the innate nature of man to worship. Am I doing this wrong, or am I just talking too loud? It seems like it's bouncing back at me a little bit. If it, okay. It's not too bad. I just don't want it to be distracting for you. But the Lord has given us from the very beginning some specific commandments, not suggestions, commandments about worship. And we're going to be dealing with them. Jesus laid the groundwork very much in Matthew chapter 4, verse 10, when he said, "Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve." There's examples in Scripture where people inadvertently tried to worship angels, and the angels were very, very quick to correct that. We've got Cain's failure to worship very early in the Genesis record, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Probably the classic New Testament passage on worship is John chapter 4, verse 24, where it says, "God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth." And my particular understanding of the concept of worshiping God in spirit and truth, spirit is the attitude with which we worship, and truth is the correctness. So we need to worship God with the right attitude, and we need to worship God in the right way. And I think that's what Jesus was alluding to the woman at the well. I have made the statement from the pulpit, and maybe some of you have heard me make the statement, that worship should not be a spectator sport. And by that I mean, I don't think the Lord designed our public worship services for us to simply come and observe. He patterned it so that we would come and participate. But I was thinking not too long ago that in one sense, our worship is a spectator sport. But the difference is, the spectator is not to be us. The spectator is to be God. God is observing our worship. The reason we come together to worship, or even our private worship, is to glorify and honor Him. In fact, I think that's why we were created. We were created to glorify and honor God. And there's simply no other acceptable explanation for you and I being here. Why else would God create us? He didn't need anything, but He did want our love, He did want our honor, and He did want our reverence. An attitude in worship is so important. Absolutely important. You remember that story about the little boy that did like many of us did as kids? He was out in the backyard practicing batting, but it was just by himself, so he'd throw the ball up and then he'd try to hit it. Well, he throws the ball up and he swings and he misses. So he tries again. He says, "Strike one." He throws the ball up again and he swings and he misses. Tries again. He throws the ball up and he swings and he misses. And he says, "Strike three." And he gets real quiet for a minute. And then he just starts jumping up and down cheering. He said, "I just struck out the best hitter in the world." You know, it was his attitude. He was trying to hit the ball. When he couldn't, he took the attitude that he was a good pitcher. Well, attitude makes a tremendous difference. It's the difference oftentimes between a good marriage and a bad. It's oftentimes the difference between a happy life and an unhappy life. And I think it is oftentimes the difference between acceptable worship and unacceptable worship. Now, there is more to it than attitude, but that certainly does play a part in it. I want to begin by going to Psalms chapter... the 27th Psalm. I guess you don't call it chapter. I know you've studied worship, so I was trying to think of passages and ways of attacking this, if you will, that might just be a little bit different. Not different in their conclusions, but different in the way we look at it. And in Psalms 27, I'm interested in the first four verses, and I'm particularly going to be interested in the fourth verse. But let me read the first four verses of Psalms 27. "The Lord," David says, "the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked," Even mine enemies and foes come upon me to eat upon my flesh. They stumbled and fell. Though an host should encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in this will I be confident. And now we get to verse 4. One thing I have desired of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in His temple. And I want to make just a few comments about that, because I think verse 4 in particular is an excellent verse for the way we need to approach worship, and we need to approach the attitude of worship. To be a person who is a true worshiper of the Lord, it will require a substantial amount of personal discipline. And I think that's one of the things that many people miss. It may be one of the things that we periodically miss in our attempts to worship, and it causes some frustration. David, when he was encountering Goliath, was extremely focused on the fact that Goliath dishonored God. And I believe that was David's motivation. I don't think his motivation was to show up his brothers or to show up the Israelite army. He was, according to 1 Samuel 17, verses 45 through 47, very concerned that Goliath wasn't showing honor to God. And sometimes I think we fail to understand that is the essence of worship, to bring honor to God. The worship service and our private or public worship is not about what it does for us. It's about what we do in terms of honoring God. Now, when we honor God, I think we are beneficiaries. He also says here in verse 4, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord. Now, I don't think David there was referring to dwelling in the tabernacle. The tabernacle wasn't set up to live in. In some respects, it wasn't large enough to live in, certainly not for all believers to live in. I think what he's talking about is he wants to dwell in the presence of the Lord, because you remember the Holy of Holies was where the Lord was. That was the essence, where the mercy seat was. So the Israelites would look at the tabernacle and that little 10 by 10 by 10 cubicle as the seat of God. And David is saying, I want to be in the presence of God. If worship doesn't bring us into the presence of God, then it seems to me that one of two or three things is wrong. Either we're worshiping the wrong thing, or we're worshiping for the wrong reason, or we're worshiping in the wrong way. When I come to the public assembly, if I do not feel that I have been in the presence of God and uplifted, I believe one of those three things I have failed on, and maybe more than one of those three things. We know that our object of worship has to be correct. And Genesis chapter 20, verse 3 says, you shall have no other gods before me. We're quite familiar with that. But I think he goes in a little further and starts to talk about the motivation of our worship. You remember the offerings that Cain and Abel made back in Genesis chapter 4, and Abel's worship or sacrifice was acceptable and Cain's wasn't. In the King James, it renders it that the Lord had not respect for Cain's offering. Now, that's an interesting phrase, because why did God not respect Cain's offering? Well, we're not given all of the information, but some would say it's because Cain's offering was grain. That could be, but later God readily accepts grain offering. It's part of the law. It's part of the way it was set up. I suspect, and the Hebrew verb that's really translated had not respect is literally did not please. It did not please. And I suspect there was an attitudinal issue with Cain as well as a functional issue. Jesus had this. In Matthew chapter 15, verses 8 and 9, Jesus has to conclude that the Pharisees' worship was empty and meaningless. It wasn't because of what they did as much as the attitude or the lack of reverence that they brought to it. Back to Psalms 27 and 4, He says, I'm going to do this all the days of my life. David could think of nothing better than to spend the rest of his life dwelling in the very presence of God. Remember what he said in Psalms 1? In his law doth I meditate day and night. It was just always on his mind. And we talked Sunday morning, those of you that were with us here at Pleasant Hill, about meditation and rumination. We are to worship God willingly. We are to worship God continually, personally, and I believe we are to worship God corporately. One of the principles that I think will help answer some of the questions that I alluded to that we're going to be touching on is you can worship God anywhere, anytime. But there are some acts of worship you cannot do individually. There are some acts of worship that God has given us that we are told to do corporately. And by corporately, I mean as the assembled congregation. And the Lord's Supper would be one of those. And I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I believe that partaking of the Lord's Supper is a dual communion. It is communion with God, but it is also, according to Scriptures, us as brothers and sisters in the Lord communing with each other. Well, I can commune with God at home, but I can't commune with you when I am isolated. We can't exhort one another in private, just one person. I can't exhort you if we both stay at home. Therefore, there are parts of worship that the Lord obviously gives us that require corporate expediency. And a lot of people don't believe that. And you'll hear them say, well, I can worship God on a mountain. I don't need to come to church to worship. Well, they're half right. They can worship God on a mountain, but they cannot implement all of the forms of worship that the Lord has given them, in my opinion, according to Scriptures. And we'll be talking about that. But that will almost answer some of the questions about what we can and can't do away from the assembly. I'm going to pause. I'm not sure that introduction will garner up questions or comments, but I want to give you the chance before I just keep going. If you have a specific question or comment you would like to ask, just raise your hand and we'll get the mic to you so that it's captured on tape. Okay. I don't see any, so I'll just keep going. Oftentimes we enjoy hearing what's called an oxymoron. And I think most of you know what we mean by an oxymoron. Oxymoron comes from two words. Oxy, which means sharp, and morose, which means dull. And an oxymoron is when you put two things that really don't match together, sharp and dull. You know, just some examples of oxymorons. At least I think they're oxymorons. Sometimes you go into a restaurant and you order jumbo shrimp. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's a shrimp. It can't be very big. But we do know what that means. Wives will use the phrase freezer burn. Now how do you burn at freezer temperatures? White chocolate. That's a good mock oxymoron. If you fly, you'll have to agree that airline food is an oxymoron. Sanitary landfill. I've never seen one of those. And I'll never see one that I think is sanitary. Truthful tabloid. That's probably not a very good one. But the oxymoron that I want to talk about now is boring worship. You ever heard someone talk about boring worship? I think that's an oxymoron because I think it's impossible. Now, I can stand up here and say, well, I know what people mean when they say that. They mean they were bored in the worship service. But I don't believe you can have boring worship. Because if our worship is boring, it's no longer worship. Because our attitude isn't right and our focus isn't right. Now, we can be bored by worship, but we're not worshiping when we're bored. So let's be very thoughtful before we use that phrase, and let's be very thoughtful before we start thinking in those terms. Reminds me of the story of a little boy who asked his mother, Mom, what is the highest number you ever counted to? Well, she couldn't think of what it was, so she asked her son, well, what's the highest number you ever counted to? And he said it was 5,372. And she said, well, why did you stop at 5,372? He said, well, that's when church was let out. The little boy was bored. But you can't really have boring worship if you think about it. There are all kinds of surveys that have been done where people say they are bored by worship. Now, I recognize that sometimes we can do things to hold our attention more during the public assembly. And I can see how to a non-Christian, maybe they don't understand and it is boring, but to a Christian, you really can't have boring worship because it's an oxymoron. It's mutually exclusive. The Bible teaches us that God does not accept all worship. God does not accept all worship. If you have your Bibles and are so inclined, I'm going to be going to Isaiah chapter 1, verse 10 and following. Isaiah chapter 1, verse 10 and following. And I want to look at just a few verses where the prophet Isaiah was having to deal with a group of people that apparently were dealing with worship with an attitude that maybe they would, if they were today's people, they would say worship was boring. But the setting for this is the nation of Israel had fallen. It had fallen into sin as a nation. But it was continuing all of its religious ceremonies. And yet we're going to see in verses 10 through 20 of Isaiah 1, God was anything but impressed. He was not at all impressed with what they considered to be their worship. And before I do a little exegesis on this, you might notice, I find it interesting, that in verse 14 of Isaiah 1, the Lord, I think with sarcasm in His voice, says, your new moons and your appointed feasts. Well, we know the moon is the Lord's, and we know the feasts were to be the Lord's, but He's saying they're yours. You have made them yours. And the Lord refuses worship when it's our worship rather than the worship of Him. And many times in churches today, and sometimes there's a gravitation toward it, even in churches of Christ, to focus our worship service on us rather than on the Lord. And I think he blanketly rejects it when that occurs. But just walk through me here for just a moment, if you will. In verse 10, it says, hear the Lord of the Lord, ye rulers of Sodom. The Lord wants everybody to hear this. The Lord's commands are for all people to hear His instruction. He wants them from the lowest to the highest. He wants them from the rich to the pauper. And He addresses the rulers. But He talks about them as being rulers of Sodom. And we talked a little bit about Sodom last night in our lesson. It was certainly a metaphor here, figuratively, for great wickedness. Then in verses 11 through 13, the Lord expresses His anger, and He starts to tell them why He's angry. Let's listen to this. To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices? I'm full of burnt offerings, of rams, of fat-fed beasts. I delight not in the blood of bullocks, of lambs, or of goats. And you come to appear before me who hath required this at your hand to tread my courts? Now these were things that the Lord had set up, but now He said, they're of no pleasure to me. He goes on and exhorts that in verses 13 and 14. In verse 15 He says, when you spread forth your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. When you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. Because their attitude was wrong. It wasn't what they were doing that was wrong. It was the attitude that was making it wrong. And God expresses very clearly His anger for that. Then in verses 16 and 17, the Lord begins to give an answer. He says, wash you, make you clean, put away the evil of your doings from before your eyes, cease to do the evil, learn to do well. In other words, clean up your act. The Israelites were going through all of the motions, but they weren't going through them with the right attitude, were they? It's an interesting group of verses that the Lord gives us there. It seems to me like here, there in Isaiah, and for us today, the Lord is appealing to everyone to come and worship Him, but it has to be done right. One of the reasons I'm happy to talk about this subject this week is there is a growing sentiment in our country, and maybe in your minds, I hope not, that it doesn't matter how we worship. Well, if I can stress anything this week, is that the Bible clearly says it matters how we worship. You ask Cain if it matters how you worship. You ask Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus chapter 6. Remember they brought in that strange fire? You ask them if it matters how you worship. There's an interesting story in 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 9. You remember Saul has the people gathered there, and Samuel is to be on his way to offer sacrifices, and Samuel seems to be late, and the people are getting restless. I have some sympathy for Paul on this particular occasion. Saul doesn't evoke my sympathy very often, but he says, you can hear him saying, well, Samuel's not here, so I'll go do it. He probably was very sincere. And the Lord sternly rebukes him, punishes him. Why? Because he wasn't a priest and Samuel was to do it. You ask Saul if it matters. Uzzah, putting his hand out to touch the ark, you ask him if it matters. Jeroboam, the kids talked about Jeroboam and Rehoboam. Jeroboam decided it would be better to place worship services throughout the land and have the people come, and he set up altars of various places. Terrible mistake. The Lord wanted his people to worship in a certain place. You ask the seven churches in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, does it make a difference? I would hope we would simply all agree that it does make a difference, but I do hear that phrase more and more. Well, does it really matter where you worship? Does it really matter what church you belong to? Etc., etc., etc. Well, I think it does. Now, some of you grew up in an atmosphere that says you have to be a member of the Church of Christ to be saved. Well, I like a little different phrase. I think we have to be a member of Christ's church in order to be saved, of which I think the Church of Christ is, or I wouldn't be a member of it. Does that mean it is absolutely impossible for a group of people with another name out in front of them, if they're doing all of what the Lord has commanded them to do it, to not be saved? No, I'm not going to take that position. I'm not advocating that we change our name. You know, there are biblical names other than the Church of Christ. The Church of the Firstborn. Church of God. I would be opposed to... I don't have any authority here. I would not recommend you change your sign to Church of the Firstborn or Church of God, because it would be very, very confusing. And I think now the Church of Christ means something to people. At least it narrows it down somewhat, and when people come into our community, and it certainly is a biblical name. But the key is to be a part of Christ's church. And certainly we can be on the rolls of churches of Christ and not necessarily be in Christ's church. And I hope this doesn't sound judgmental, but there are probably groups that have a sign in front of their building that says Church of Christ that may not be part of Christ's church. As my oldest son said, anybody could put a sign in the yard, but you have to then find out what various beliefs are. Okay. Anybody have a comment or question on anything that I've said so far before I kind of move out of my introduction? Okay. If you're asleep, your eyes are mostly open. So that's good. I want to talk a little bit about what constitutes a public worship assembly. And we're going to be dealing primarily this week with what I use the term corporate worship. I don't mean that as a corporation. I just mean that as a body, as a congregational assembly. But there are personal, private worship settings given to us in the Bible. For instance, an example of a private worship setting would be Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, Matthew chapter 26, verse 36 and following. Peter, when he prayed on the housetop, you remember in Acts chapter 10, that would be private worship. The healing of Dorcas in Acts chapter 9, verse 36 and following, was a private thing. In the Bible, in the New Testament, there are also examples of small gatherings that maybe weren't the entire church. There was a prayer meeting recorded in Acts chapter 12, verse 12, at Mary, Martha's, the mother of Mark's, and they were praying there for Peter to be released from prison. That was a small group gathering. Paul and Silas in the jail at Philippians. They were singing and praying, worshiping the Lord in a small group setting. But there are many times in scriptures where the assembling of the church is clearly meant. In Acts chapter 14, verse 27, the Antioch church in its totality, at least they were all invited, were called together to receive edification from Paul and Barnabas as they returned from their second missionary journey. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 19 and following, the church at Corinth obviously was coming together to worship. And there we have an exhortation, one of the four major exhortations in the New Testament on the Lord's Supper. And we'll deal with that more in detail. In Acts chapter 20, verse 7, it's clear that the church at Troas came together on the first day of the week to commemorate the Lord's Supper. In 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 and 2, there's a reference to the collection. And they assembled, this was the whole congregation, on the first day of the week. An interesting note on that, if you use the King James Version, of which I tend to do, that's one passage where it leaves out a very important detail, because the literal Greek in 1 Corinthians 16 and 2 says every first day of the week. It doesn't just say the first day of the week, it says every first day of the week. Four times Paul talks about the assembling of the church in the essence of correcting abuses of spiritual gifts. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 4, Paul says, when you assemble, he doesn't say if you assemble, he says when you assemble, there is the presumption that the church will assemble. And the examples we have is the assembling on the first day of the week. Also, you have that same presumption by Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 20. But their essence of those elements in worship were for the assembled congregation, not for individual worship. That's why ecclesia, really, we translate it church, but it really means the assembly. It is the assembling of the saints together. Now I'm going to next talk about Matthew chapter 18, verse 20, where it says, if two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in their presence. Because I find that to be a passage that is time after time after time taken out of context to justify things that I don't think the Lord ever intended to be justified. But before I go to that, I will pause one more time and see if anybody has a comment or a question. Okay, if not, I'm going to be in Matthew chapter 18. And if you've heard anybody, or if you've used the context of, well, where two or three are gathered together, there we have an assembly for worship, I might urge you to go with us there, at least mentally, if not more so. The passage that is often cited in Matthew chapter 18, verse 20, it simply says, for where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them. Obviously a true statement. The out of context, in my estimation, is that is often meant, often taken by some people to say, well, as long as there's two or three of us as Christians, we can do all of the corporate worship things that the Lord has asked us to do. I do not believe what that verse is saying at all. And let me at least take a few moments to explain to you why I don't believe that. If you look back up in verse 15 and following, the context of verse 20 is church discipline. In verse 15, he says, if a brother trespasses against you, you go to him one-on-one and you try to work it out. Verse 16, if that doesn't work, you go back to him and you take one or two people with you. If that doesn't work, then we find in verse 17 and following, it may need to be brought before the entire congregation. The context of this whole discussion is church discipline. Now, it's interesting to note that Jesus is saying, when we've got a problem, work it out at the lowest level possible and don't involve any more people than you need to. If two people can work it out, it shouldn't go any further. If not, two or three or four people, you work it out. And then don't let it go any further. Last resort is to bring it before the congregation and get a lot of people involved. And that's not human nature, is it? Usually, rather than going one-on-one, we talk to probably about everybody else about it before we go to the person that we ought to talk about it. But again, that's not an issue of worship. But then when he gets down to verse 20, he's talking about church discipline. And he's saying, if only two or three of you have enough courage to do this, I'm going to be with you. He is not talking, in my estimation, about corporate worship at all. But this verse is often used for having corporate worship assemblies doing things that I think should be done in the congregational worship service and not in individual small groups. And I know that you won't all agree with me here, and I say it with love, but I say it with concern too. Because we often find ourselves thinking, well, it's not convenient to be in the assembly, so we'll do these various things wherever we're at. And often this is on vacation, but it's not always just on vacation. Well, I think that's not the assembling of the saints together that the Lord had in mind when he instituted the Lord's Supper and he instituted these various things. Yes, where two or three are gathered together, he is there, but where one of us is there, the Lord's with us if we're Christians. That's not the issue. The issue is, does Matthew 18:20 really have to do with corporate worship? I don't think it does. I think it has to do with church discipline, not with corporate worship. But I see and hear it used out of context so often to rationalize. If I really believed that where two or three are gathered together gave me a license for corporate worship, my wife and I and my sons would never leave the house on Sunday morning because we wouldn't need to. We could have our own communion. We could have our own songs. We could study. We could teach. And I don't think that's what the Lord had in mind at all. And I'm not saying that you do either. But if I really thought this was about corporate worship, that would be very convenient. That would be very convenient. Now, I know that was a very quick synopsis of what I think on that, but let me give you a chance to comment on that or to state another position on that if you would like. I just find it to be very, very important. And as I go through communion and mutual edification and singing and praying, that will be a very key principle that I'll be pulling on throughout the week. So if we need to discuss it, this would be a good time to do that discussion. Just a minute. Just so they can hear you. I can hear you.
This might be premature. You might be answering this later on, but you keep talking about vacation. And so my question is that if you cannot find a worship service like ours where you have mutual edification and, you know, you sing a cappella and Lord's Table and whatnot, are there, what are the, oh, I don't know how to phrase it appropriately, but like what are the essential items that you look for so that you're not, I mean, I don't keep wanting to say a waste of time. I know it's not a waste of time, but you know what I'm saying, where it's not something that is 100% right. Is that, are there certain things that are, do you feel that are more important than others, or what can you do when you're in an area where you can't find an appropriate service?
Okay, that's a well of a good question, to which I will not give an equally thorough answer, but I'll do my best. But before I say it, these are areas where we all have to use our own judgment. He really is working out our own salvation with fear and trembling, and I don't want to be judgmental. But she asked a question, so I'll tell you what guides me. Let me put it that way. There are going to be times where beyond your control you may find yourself in that situation, and I'll talk about those. If it's in your control, my guiding principle is don't let myself get into those situations. And for me personally, that means there are places that I that I won't go on vacation if I don't feel I can find a place to worship. And I have not always felt that way, so I'm not casting any stones. When we were first married, before we had children, my wife and I went on a couple of 2-week cruises. And she was a travel agent, so we went free. So we didn't have any money. But that's neither here nor there. But I wouldn't do that now, because there's just no way you can assemble with saints the way I'm defining it on a cruise ship. That doesn't mean I'll never go on a cruise. It just means it's going to leave on Monday and come back on Saturday. And I may cruise for 3 months, but it'll always be Monday through Saturday. But that's a little bit of an extenuating situation. But when we do travel, we do find ourselves in situations where we won't find a church that's completely like every aspect of our home congregation. That's probably true. And that's where I'm just going to have to tell you what tends to guide me. What really guides me is absolutely necessary for me is that their worship service has to be, as best I can tell, in accordance with scriptures. I could not, in good conscience, worship with a group that uses instrumental music, for instance. I just don't think that would be right. I would not worship with a group that didn't partake of the Lord's Supper on every first day of the week. That just wouldn't work for me. Now, there may be situations where a church would maybe use their funds in a way that I wouldn't be totally comfortable with. But you don't always know that. What guides me there is I usually wait until I come home and I give my contribution to my home congregation or a congregation I know so that I know my funds will be used. But having said that, we have some resources available to us now that even a decade ago weren't available. And it's called the Internet. And it's got a lot of bad things on it, but there are a lot of pretty good church directories on there that you can find a lot about, find their practices, find phone numbers, emails. You can call ahead and find out and not try to put yourself in that position. Now, there are people that are more conservative than I am on that, and probably more people that are more liberal than I am on that. But I just, over the years, have found it difficult for me to get comfortable with compromising my worship to the Lord so that I can have a particular recreation for myself. That just seems to me to be, a juxtaposition of priorities. And I hope that you take that in the spirit that it's meant, but I have to be honest in the way I believe and the way I feel. Anybody want to ask a follow-up question or answer that question in a different way?
It isn't really a follow-up question. It's just an observation. We've been to a few different congregations where perhaps our research wasn't the greatest going in. Mm-hmm. And some of the times we got a real, I guess this is a perhaps a suggestion for elderships, I guess, perhaps, not if nothing else you call it. But we get different feelings from the group as we go in, as we'd meet with the people, you know, and they'd ask, you know, are you a instrumental or a acapella group, whatever. And of course, you know, what we would say was, you know, that we didn't believe in the instrumental. They would be very candid, very nice about it, but say, you know, in such and such, not too far from here, there is that group. So I was always appreciative of those people who were up front with that situation. And again, like you said, now we have a little better mechanism to search it out. And again, I guess I were a little older to know that, you know, there's a better way to approach it than just walking the door, perhaps. We always appreciated, and I always thought that would be something that we as a congregation might be a little more receptive to that type of thing too, as we have our visitors.
I think it's a good point. And most people are they're going to try to be nice about it. And if you say this is what I'm looking for, they'll And I've done that on the telephone. I'll call, and I can't tell from the directory really what it is. I'll call the person or email them and ask them more questions. And I'll say, well, it sounds like you're looking for, and they'll give me another name or an address. And there are churches all around. If you want to go to Hawaii, you just go. There's a congregation on Oahu and Maui both. There's a couple of them in England. There's one in Oahu in France, if you can speak French. Otherwise, you'll need an interpreter. But, you know, it doesn't just nail you down. And you can get, you know, you can do the best job of searching and still make an honest mistake. I did that once. I found a church. I don't remember what state we were in, and I always went Saturday night to see if I could find it because I knew I'd get lost Sunday morning. And we were pulling in just as everyone was leaving, and that didn't look good. Come to find out, they had their what we call the assembly worship service first and then the classes. So we were getting there, and the whole thing was over. Well, I didn't feel good about that, but I think God knew I made an honest effort, so I hope He forgave me. The boys were young enough, they thought that was kind of funny. And one Sunday they didn't have to go to church, and we've all been there, done that. Teresa?
Going back to boring worship.
Yes, ma'am.
I've come to the conclusion that it is important to find a lesson in all lessons, and if it is our attitude, then we should pray, knowing that maybe this person that is not as eloquent giving a lesson, that we should pray for our attitude and pray for the person giving the lesson so that we could have the right attitude and get something out of it.
Well said. Thank you very, very much. I would rather hear a non-eloquent, sincere man than the most eloquent, non-sincere man. And I've never heard a lesson that I couldn't get something out of. Obviously, we all hear some that we get more out of. But sometimes that's just our mindset on the way. You know, preparation for worship is something that many times we let slip. And maybe instead of watching the news at 8 o'clock till 9 o'clock, time to leave church, maybe a little reading of the scripture would better prepare our minds, etc., etc. You use your own judgment there, but and I'm guilty of this too, so I'm not casting any stones, but oftentimes we arrive at the worship assembly and our minds are on a lot of things other than worship. And most of us can't just flip that switch on and off. So, just something for us to work on personally. Not to be critical, just so we can get better. Do I have another one? Jolene. I got to bring those kids up in a minute. Go ahead.
Way back to the beginning, you said that you thought God was being sarcastic. Do you really think God would be sarcastic?
Oh, yeah.
You don't think He's above that? I just think that's a really human thing.
I don't think we're above that.
We're not above it. I just can't.
Well,
I can't picture God being sarcastic.
Well, when He says your feasts and your moons, they weren't their feasts and their moons. I think He was saying you've turned them into your feasts. Now, maybe there's a better thesaurus' word than sarcastic, and I'll accept that. But I think God has a sense of humor, and sarcasm is one form of humor, I'm told. I haven't experienced it, but I'm told. I hope He has a sense of humor, because we're funny. We are funny. If we're made in His image, He must have a sense of humor, because most of us do. There's a few of us that don't, but we'll call you out. Just kidding. Okay, anybody else have a comment or a question? Marvin. But Julian, I didn't mean that in a sense of it being any way disparaging toward God. I just think God gets frustrated. And as I read the scriptures, sometimes as I read them, I feel that frustration percolating in humor sometimes, and maybe a little bit of sarcasm.
I wonder if we aren't... if we aren't deceived sometimes by thinking that we have to have a certain number of people in order to conduct a corporate worship.
Okay, go ahead.
It seems to me like that Paul in Corinthians there, he he says we ought to be able to look over and see the body of Christ present. Well, if there's only four people in the town that are Christians, then they can conduct a corporate worship. That's what I'm concerned about.
If I understand you, I agree the number of people involved has nothing to do with it. But I do believe whether it is an established group of people, I'm going to call them a congregation. I think if my and my family are, pick a town, we're not a congregation. But you can have a congregation of two people. But it's an established group of people that regularly meet. To me, that's the key. Not how many. It's that they do. Tomorrow night we'll continue this if you have any other thoughts on it, but we will be dealing with the communion. What is its purpose? How should we partake of it? Taking it to nursing homes multiple times a day, and some congregations do that. And if we have time, we may talk about the multiple cup, one cup, but I don't think that's as big of an issue for most of us in a practical sense than these others. So, thank you.